Chuck Sullivan, welcome to the Bluminati Podcast.
Thanks, Colin. It's great to be here.
We are very glad to have you. So give the folks at home who don't know you, and we work with you, you know, every year at events like this. We see you in Clearwood or at the baseball tournament every year. But you are day-to-day, basically all communications for the conference.
Correct. Yeah, so my job is basically any front-facing communications that has to do on behalf of the conference. And with that comes, to some degree, what we call the blocking and tackling, maintaining the standings, the statistics, the nuts and bolts of basically a collegiate sports league. With our league, where it's a little different than maybe some others, is I think we do a little bit more on the promotional push, the PR push. Some of it strategically, some of it reactionary, some of it by design. But all of it, I think, is, when you put the two together, that's really the job in a nutshell. That the nuts and bolts of the maintaining the integrity of the league office and the information that comes out of it, but also really advancing some of the narratives that we want to try to tell.
You guys are pushing a narrative? I can't tell. Let me take my phone off this wireless charging case that says Power 5 on Power 6 on.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, the Power 6 campaign was one that really came about, I guess, and really put into place last year in full effect. It's kind of always has existed ever since, I think, we've been in existence as the American from 2013. Commissioner Oresko has been pretty clear that he wants to be part of the Power Group for a lot of reasons. If it was going to be clear that there was going to be a dividing line in intercollegiate athletics, we wanted to make sure that we were above it. And, based on a lot of things, we had schools that were above it previously and continue to operate as if they are, and others that strove to be there, and there was no in the landscape that was coming about, there was no definitive reason for why one should be above it and one should not. So we felt competitively we were always going to be at least on a par and be able to tell that story. And fortunately, we now have, I think, some results to back that up. So the Power 6 campaign that came about last year, once we had kind of a body of work to trumpet, was really said, let's really walk the walk, talk the talk. Our schools are doing these things anyway, in terms of legislation and everything that the autonomy conferences are doing. Let's put it into practice and put it on helmets, on decals, and here in Newport at our media day, and really tell people what we are and what we're trying to be.
And certainly I think the UCF, however you feel about the national championship push, it almost seems to be a split part of that narrative, is that these schools can compete with anyone.
At the end of the day, that's what it is. UCF, there's no doubt that they, if you were to play any team in the country, could beat any team in the country, on a given day. And by extension, USF could as well last year, as we saw the fact that they played UCF to the best game I've ever seen in person. And you could say the same about Memphis, that on the right day, Memphis could beat any team in the country. So I think, going from last year alone, and that's saying nothing about what Houston did in years past, and what UCF did back in 13, and teams like Temple have done since coming on board. We think the results are there, and reasonable people can agree or disagree on whether UCF is the national champion. But it would be nice to see if they had a shot, what they would have done. And I think the commissioner's convinced. I'm convinced that they could have played a game against any team in the country and come out on top of it.
Yeah, I don't know about the national title narrative, but I definitely think that they were one of the best. They could have competed. They could have absolutely played on the same field with Alabama, not.
Yeah, and the thing that came out, and this is where the kind of the labeling and the PR push comes out, right? Is the Power 6 campaign is to say, is to basically align ourselves with those other conferences that we consider our peer conferences. But where you see it kind of come into play is almost the narrative comes in, and we might talk about a little bit as well, but you go back to even when in 2007 when USF got as high as number 2 in the country. Now, I remember watching, they unveiled the BCS rankings on Fox. I think it was Jimmy Johnson who said, well, I'll tell you what, I don't know who the number 2 team in the country is, but there's no way it's USF.
And I remember that.
And just by, why is the results say otherwise, the computers say otherwise, when you take the human bias that comes into it out of it, you can see that they clearly are and should have been at that time. And I think that's kind of where we are with our teams, is we have everything but the 80 years of history to kind of back up some of the things that we're doing now. So when people would talk about last year, UCF's strength of schedule and how it was, well, not as strong. Well, guess what? It compared very favorably to some other teams that were ranked substantially higher with common opponents. There's one in particular that plays in the Big Ten that if you were gonna ding, you know, UCF for their schedule, there's another school that you can hang the same thing, but they were ranked, you know, significantly higher at the same time, given the same body of work. And then you get into factors like the eye test and game control and things like that. And our commissioner has been very strong in saying, you know, that's not really the stuff you need to be, you know, worrying about when you're evaluating teams that should be playing for the championship.
Game control. I love that they throw game control into the four just so, you know what, we kind of think. It's just sort of that leaves the door open for them to make some changes.
Yeah, and I'll put the full disclaimer. I had the opportunity last year to serve on the mock selection committee for the college football playoffs. So that's where you take a sample year, a year that actually played out, and so I think we did the 2014 season and actually rank it under the college football playoff format. And it's incredible the way the depth of information that's available to the committee members. The commissioner and everyone associated with our conference has great respect for the committee. We're in touch with the committee, you know, constantly during the season. We have reps assigned to our conference, and their job is to know everything about the goings on in our conference. And we have weekly calls with them during the season to make sure that they're up to date and they know injury situations or any mitigating factors that might have affected a result. So that said, there's a wealth of information available to that committee, and there's great respect for that process. That said, I think, you know, just the thing that we're trying to fight and that our commissioner has led the charge on is just trying to eliminate that human bias. And it was, you know, Scott Frost said at the end of last season that there's a deliberate, you know, I think it was a deliberate bias to keep our teams ranked too low, so that when they had success, they were just, there was the kind of a ceiling that, and I agreed with it somewhat. I don't think it's necessarily deliberate. I think maybe an unconscious thing that can set come into play, just again based on history. You know, people, and I found it even in the room when I did the mock selection with the CFP, where we went through the exercise, and one of the other participants in it said, "Well, wait a minute, are we really putting Michigan, you know, down here when they had it?" And well, why? Just because they're Michigan, right? Of course they should be higher, right? Because for no other reason than they have the brand name. So that's just the kind of thing that we're trying to work through in our conference. And I think we've made some progress there. I think people are beginning to notice with some of the results, and certainly UCF has done their part. Last year in terms of they haven't been afraid to, you know, to stake their claim as to what they are and what they think they are.
So they have not been. and plus the thing that I would say with the UCF, they lost an overtime game to Memphis and a one score game to Austin. Maybe it was one of the best games you'll ever see.
Right.
So does that also show that that there is not just one team? It's not just a one team conference. There's a lot of, there's some depth there that's also really a decent quality.
Yeah, I think in recent years our top and our middle has been really strong, and you can make a case that our bottom could have done a little bit better. But those top teams, the three that you mentioned, USF has been right there. I mean, they're on their best run of double digit win totals that we've seen in their existence. 07 was what it was, in a magical run. But according to the records, this has been a better run. Memphis, the same thing. You know, they've scored they've done it in the conference now. The commissioner is very fond of saying this is not your grandfather's Memphis team. So even Memphis of 10 years ago, and even when their first year in the league, I think they struggled pretty well out of the chute, and then made two great coaching hires to build it back up. So there's real strength at the top, and has been. I think this is the year maybe you find that the top and the bottom get a little closer together, and there's maybe a little more depth from top to bottom. It's not probably not realistic to expect a team to go 12-0, 13-0. It's just those seasons. Sure. It hadn't happened since 2014 that a team ran the table for the season. But it's not unreasonable to think that we could have three teams sitting there at 10-2 at the end of the year, 11-1, and with the bottom all sitting at, you know, 4 wins, 5 wins, are all knocking on the door of bowl eligibility. You can look at the West Division and think that that all six could be bowl eligible by the end of the year if things play out a certain way.
For sure.
Yeah.
We were just talking last night how close Tulane got. So you worked, Boston University grad, went to Princeton, worked there for 2 years, 4 years at a D3 in Massachusetts.
Yep.
and then Bryant University, and then you end up as an SID at Harvard. Now, what I know of Harvard is that their athletics program has like 30-some sports.
42 now. It was 41 when I was there. Then they've added women's rugby since I left. But it was 40. Yeah, it was 41 when I was there. Yeah.
So what are the challenges of working at a program where everybody's brilliant, they're not really there for sports, and you're covering 40-some sports?
Sure. The myth is there are a good number of people who are there for sports, though.
Really?
So that's, yeah, there's a lot of the student-athletes really.
Definitely there for sports.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and they're there for the total package. So I'll put on my Harvard PR hat and think that it's, you know, the opportunity you have there to achieve an elite education and compete in Division I athletics is really what draws people to the Ivies. And then the game changer in basketball that allows like maybe a Jeremy Lin. Actually, he might have been before the financial aid policy changed, but they Harvard went across the board to strictly need-based financial aid. So it had nothing to do with merit, had nothing to do with grades. If you just, it was all based on your family's income and what you could afford to pay. And for a sport like basketball, which maybe trends towards on the lower end of the medium for incomes, it's almost like having athletic scholarships. So unless your family made six figures, you could go to Harvard for free. And in some sports where one or two people can make a difference, that's been a game changer. And that's why suddenly Harvard became, and the Ivies in general, have made more of an impact in the NCAA tournament. But working there was, I grew up in New England. I'm a lifelong New Englander, and that was always my dream job, to work at Harvard, and just be in that environment. And the neat thing about there is you never knew when, you know, the president of China was going to be giving a speech across over the business school, or your phone was going to ring, who was going to be on the other end of it. The opportunity to work with just a great, well-rounded group of students. And as I said earlier, we had an Olympic medalist who's one of our student workers, and we're having her, take notes at a lacrosse game or something like that. And, in between her practices for hockey where she was a member of the U.S. team, or knowing full well that all of my student workers were going to make immediately more money than I did the second they graduated. So that was always interesting. But it was a great experience to go there. And like I said, I loved every day working there.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And so you came to this conference in 2007, the miracle season.
Yeah.
And what, don't want to dwell on the negative here, but
sure.
We saw the evolution of what was happening, and things seemed to be in 2006, 7, 8, when you first got here, it seemed like everything was on the upswing and everybody was pulling in the rope in the same direction and everything. And then
right. That
thread slowly started to pull away and the sweater just sort of evaporated. What did you see on your side? What were the big moments that jumped out at you as how things could have gone differently? What could have happened?
Sure. I haven't read this. I've read Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, and I know this other book is The Tipping Point, which I've not read. If I point to a tipping point with a conference, I almost point to in 07, the West Virginia Pitt game that year,
Where
West Virginia, if they beat Pitt, it was a 5-win Pitt team, if I'm not mistaken, or 4-win Pitt team, maybe even going into the game. Mm-hmm. And if they could just hold serve against Pitt in the last game of the regular season in the backyard brawl the day after Thanksgiving, they're playing for the national championship. The way it shook out was, I think it was supposed to be Missouri, and I can't remember the other team, was 1-2. They both lost. West Virginia wins. And I think West Virginia was 3 going in. And if they won that game, though, the two teams ahead of them both lost, they would have been playing for the national championship. They didn't. It was a Pitt pulls the upset of upsets.
I remember Juan Step running out on the field going crazy.
Exactly. That was then. I'm not sure that then Rich Rodriguez leaves to go to Michigan if they're playing for the national championship, because I think he can accomplish everything there. The conference would have had potentially a national championship. I'm convinced they would have mopped the floor with, I think it was Ohio State on the other side. That West Virginia team was stacked. With all due respect to Ohio State and LSU who played in that game. I would have put the Mountaineers as a pretty comfortable winner, I think, in that game as it played out. And I think just a lot of the dominoes that ended up following, at least in the conference, might have gone differently if that result went a different way. I think with a national championship under the belt of the kind of reinvigorated Big East with USF and Cincinnati and UConn as part of it, that would have been a nice feather in the cap that might have, I don't know if it would have staved anything off, but it might have been something that we could have in the arsenal when it came up for media rights negotiations and things like that. Whether there's validity to that, I could be way off base entirely, but I always view that one as kind of something that if that had just trended the other way, I wonder what might have happened. That said, there was so still some great moments after the fact with the Big East, and we go to the other one that kind of maybe when you get to Nirvana and you say, this is pretty awesome, was the 6 overtime game in men's basketball at Madison Square Garden with UConn and Syracuse, and you're watching history being made, these two storied programs slug it out on the court, and you say, boy, how can this go horribly wrong, or how is this, tell me you can't make this work. The day that kind of changed everything, I worked for John Paquette at the Big East, who hired me. He had been the PR director, communications director of the conference for about 25 years. And he has a really good pulse on things. And he lived through it with the first go around of realignment in that conference. And it was the day that the Big Ten publicly at least announced that they would consider the prospect of expanding. There were some rumors going around that maybe, I think it was at the time that Nebraska might be looking to jump out of the Big 12 or something. The exact time frame was a blur. But the Big Ten did put out a statement that said that they were going to investigate the possibility of realigning. And that's when I remember John vividly coming into our office and saying, okay, our job's just changed. This is a new world now, then, because he had lived through that before and knew that things might be starting to fall there.
And the famous TV negotiation, there's a deal on the table, and the schools say, we want more.
Yeah.
What do you remember about? I don't know how close were you involved in that meeting, or if you were even in the room or whatever.
Right. I was not, actually. So I just know that the game changer with that was when the Pac-12 announced their deal. So I think the takeaways, as I understand it, was that there was a deal or an offer from our existing partner with ESPN at the time that was I think amenable to most of the parties involved. And then the market kind of reset a bit. At least our presidents thought that the market reset a bit once the Pac-12 offer came in deal went through. And that's what maybe caused a step back to look at it. But again, I don't know the exact mechanics of it at the time. I was not deeply involved in that process.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So now you've seen the sort of rebirth of this conference and starting to slowly grow and taking on teams like, SMU and Tulane and schools that football-wise have struggled a little bit. How has that changed your day-to-day? Is it much more about promotion of the league now as it was before, maybe like management of?
Yeah, there is. There is more of that because we're trying to, the example I give there is, so I've now worked now at the conference now, this will be year 12, and when I go to a family function, my brother-in-law will say to me, okay, now who's in your conference again? Yeah. And this is a guy who's a sports fan and loves college sports, but still just doesn't quite equate it all together. So that's really one of the issues that we're fighting there, at least on the conference side. And there's no geographic necessarily reason for our schools to be together. What they have in common is they all want to be good.
Right.
They've either been good and want to continue to be, or want to be in the company of other schools that are and are willing to invest to do so. And they have a nice platform, I think, with our schools and our exposure and our media rights to be able to do that. So the landscape has changed a little bit in terms of my day-to-day role. For me, like I said, when I was at Harvard, I considered it my dream job. When I went to the conference, it was primarily for family reasons. My son was born, and the idea of chasing 41 sports around and having to deal with all that stuff suddenly became less intriguing. Whereas the conference life was, it's a little more stable and corporate in terms of how it's how it operates. We don't have to go to every game. We know when our extended trips are going to be, when our busy times are going to be. It's much more, you're much more able to get in front of things and plan accordingly and know when you're going to be kind of up against it. But that said, I also had a fair number of friends. Dan Gavitt, who I worked for at Bryant, was the associate commissioner of men's basketball at the Big East. And I would, if he asked me tomorrow to come and work with him on the moon, I would start building my rocket. He's just a guy that I respect that much, in this space. So when the opportunity to work with him again at the conference office really made the Big East experience really enjoyable. That said, when we made the transition to the American, we saw a real opportunity with these new schools. I didn't know a soul at SMU. I didn't know a soul at Tulane or Tulsa or anything else. But the opportunity to get to know them and get to know their coaches and their student athletes, it was really eye-opening. And they're terrific people to deal with. And so the goal then became to do a great job for these schools that I knew didn't really know anything about and had not worked with, and really try to just give all the energy I could to them that I was giving to the ones previously.
And now, as we had known before, but as Mr. Oresco said in his announcement this morning, it's possible we're all heading to Dallas here. So maybe not next year, but sometime in, you know,
sure.
We probably got one more clam bake in us, fortunately.
Yeah, I think, well, we're making the push that, and I think he's on board too, is the idea is we might try to stick a contract in front of his face to keep the clam bake here going in perpetuity, because we had such a great experience with it last night. I think everybody much is unanimous in their support of it. So even if the office was elsewhere, you know, we could still do this event here in Newport, where I think we've built a little bit of a brand. What I tell our staff is I think it's the best thing that we do on the conference side, and it's one thing that we do probably better than any other conference, I'm proud to say, is put on this mm-hmm. event that I think in terms of access and in terms of the parties that are all here under the same roof for the same reason, I think I would selfishly say that this might be the best, and I hear that just from enough people externally to be able to say that without to sound like I'm bragging too much. So the hope is that whatever happens where the office location is, and I think you could put the office on the moon, it doesn't matter where, as long as you can just get to your schools and get to games. But I think having this event here is really a nice feather in our cap.
Yeah, this was my first time in Newport, and it's mm-hmm. been just an absolute blast. The clam bake was fantastic. Just, you know, especially today, I mean, we got Kevin Agandi, we got Coach Ken. I mean, we've talked to a lot of people, and they're open and honest, and it just seems like this atmosphere kind of helps.
It lends yourself.
Yeah, and I think it's nice to inherit that. The clam bake and the Newport experience kind of came about before I started with the conference. With I think the architects behind it were three people: John Paquette, who I mentioned before, Nick Carparelli, who's now at Under Armour, was mm-hmm. our associate commissioner for football, and John Marinato, the former commissioner at the time, was the associate commissioner of the conference. And I think when the first go around with realignment happened, the idea of moving the media days from a nameless, faceless Marriott in New Jersey to somewhere a little more of a destination, and bringing the bowl people and the television partners and over, and kind of combining the two events with our media day with a kind of a hospitality event for our guests. So they had that brainchild about 15 years ago or so. And being able to sustain it and grow it, it's really grown in its scope now, where we had 42 players here. We were well over 100 on the media side. Now, granted, that's not what the SEC, I think, gets that for, by the time they've had breakfast on the first day, they'll be well over those numbers. But I think that the notion behind our event, and it stems from Commissioner Oresco's desire to really push the narrative and be open to the media and transparent in many ways, is that we want our coaches to be accessible, and we want people to get to know them as human beings, as personalities, and not just a coach that where you're held behind a rope, and a coach gets up and speaks for 10 minutes and he's gone, and on the plane back to whatever school he's going to an hour later. You get to spend the night with them in a social setting at the clam bake, and you can talk to them about their families, as opposed to what their backup right guard is going to be doing. And then we have time to talk about the backup right guard here on the second day here on Tuesday. So
we did plenty of that today.
Yeah.
With the conference, I mean, you're a New England guy. You've been here, most all of your life, basically.
Sure.
Heading to Dallas, would you stay here? How's that going to work for you?
Yeah, we'll see what happens there. As much as I do now on the move, because he's about 3 years ago, the commissioner brought us in and explained that this was on the horizon, that such a move was likely. Factual purposes, the lease in our office expires or is up June, at the end of June in 2020. So we have to go somewhere then. If we don't renew where we are, we're going to have to go somewhere. And he's obviously made no secret of his desire to move the office there. That's where I might see if I could leverage a couple of years in my and say, I could work from home and get things done from there. And if I need to parachute into Dallas for a couple of times a month for meetings, and I'd certainly be able to do that. But or you'd have to take a hard look at it too. Like I said, I'm fairly well rooted in this area, and love working where I work though too. So I understand both ends of it. We'd have to take a hard look at it though.
Quickly, non-football related, the baseball tournament you guys put together mm-hmm. in Clearwater this year, with the weather, and you guys were still able to pull off just a fantastic event. Like, I feel like everyone else would have messed that up.
Right.
Especially with USF won two games for the first time in a conference tournament for the first time in like 8 years or something like that.
And they were in many ways the team that was almost disadvantaged the most by the format, where I think they had games 3 days in a row, which or potential doubleheaders and multiple days in a row, which on the second field. Yeah, the credit for that would go strictly to Jim Sidlitsky, who's our associate commissioner for sport administration and sponsorships, and he just has a nose for a lot of the nuances that go into building schedules and brackets and things. Like, just that's really, I mean, I've never seen a greater expert in that space than he. He just knows the ins and outs and why this works and why this wouldn't work. And he was in front of it from the day we arrived at Clearwater. Said, listen, the weather looks lousy. If we lose games on the front end, you're chasing it in the back end, and there's a risk we don't complete the tournament, because the tournament has to be completed by, I think it's by Sunday, Sunday, or else
no auto bid.
Correct. And the auto bid goes to, it's declared by either the highest remaining seed or, the tournament champion is the highest remaining seed. There's no champion, and the auto bid would go to the highest remaining seed. I believe that was the mechanics behind it. I have to go back to my policy manual to look for sure. but we were very clear, because the coaches made clear to us, is they want to make sure that the champion was decided on the field. So we operated with that, get the tournament in. And he really recognized that with the weather being what it looked like, let's just get games in the bank early. And if we had to, do 4 games in 3 days down the stretch, okay, we could do that. That's a possibility. But if you're trying to get 8 games in 3 days down the stretch, you're really up the creek, and that's not what we want to do. Absolutely. So when the second field became an option, and we're fortunate that we play at a facility that can accommodate it too. The Threshers facility in Clearwater is magnificent. They have good press box food, of course, is the most important thing.
Cheesesteak Day. It's our favorite thing.
The grounds crew is off the charts good. Their attention to detail is amazing. And not just on the main field at Spectrum Field, but the 4 practice fields that the Phillies use. Mm-hmm. Those are major league caliber fields. That's where they have their spring training and even their extended spring training was going on while we were there. And they were good enough to move off the better of their 4 fields to move them, their own team off of the better field there to allow us to do it. And then so the challenge then became, okay, well, we would have a field to play on, but there was zero amenities. There's 2 rows of bleachers, for the, 10 people and scouts that may go to their games that they have. We could probably piece together a scoreboard, but there was going to be no internet, no radio coverage. So your radio crews were going to be out of luck. And then and just no ancillary coverage of the games on that field. And then once we made the transition to have some games on that field, it's like, hey, well, we might be able to accommodate radio if we can run this and just kind of jury-rigged a lot of different solutions for the various for the things. Our streaming vendor, L2 Productions, was great in saying, listen, if we could get a camera set up somewhere, we can put the game on. So we put it behind the backstop, which is less than ideal, but the alternative was zero. It was not having it at all. So at least we figured we could deal with a few social media jabs at how poor the screen looked, but at least you were able to get a call of the game, and we got an announcer over there and a video camera to at least give some level of coverage to games taking place at that field. Not ideal. I mean, obviously, we'd love to have everything in our major league ready stadium across the way that's fully functional for it. But I think the credit goes to Jim for really building that schedule out to allow for that tournament to get completed.
We say this all the time, people can have arguments about the conference as a whole and what the direction is and all that kind of stuff and strategy. The on-the-ground operations that we see from not just you but from all the staff of the league is just first class all the way. And it has been a joy and a pleasure to deal with you guys. And I know that we get a personal touch that you would never see at some bigger conferences and bigger places. You guys put the work in every single day, and we actually see it. It's amazing.
Thanks. That's great to hear. We do try to operate. We view ourselves very much as a service entity, and whatever organization we're in. We exist because 12 member schools or 13, if you count the football only and whatnot. Yeah. We exist because they say we can. Right. I think a lot of conferences may be more driven as a top-down agenda where the conference is driving what the schools ought to be doing. We look to our schools to tell us how to operate, and we lend expertise in areas where we have them. But by and large, the direction of the conference, we exist to serve the membership and by extension serve the media and serve our public and our fans. So we take that seriously and try to operate in that way, I think, in every way. We're always looking for feedback. If there's something that we're not doing right, we want to know about it so we can take it under advisement and correct it. So that's... I know a lot of people say it, but I really do think that we take it to heart and really try to operate in that mindset.
So if we could just get Mr. Oresco over here, then we'll have him sign that contract for a 25-year extension here at Gurney's every year before you sign the lease in Dallas. And
right. Exactly. Exactly.
Awesome. Thanks, Chuck, for doing this. We really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Enjoyed it.